In these early weeks of the summer, Swami was putting the finishing touches on his biography of the Holy Mother. Writing in his study, which was below the shrine room in Vivekananda Cottage. Each day in mid-morning, the households of the three cottages would assemble in the living room of Vedanta Cottage as the author sat at a small table reading to us from his manuscript. Swami Madhavananda would sit in a large armchair and was solicited at intervals for comments or criticism. August and silent, he seldom had any to offer unless it were in regard to some error of fact known to him. Swami Buddhananda was the most frequent commentator. He seemed to feel it incumbent upon him to play the gadfly role, and he did it as best he could, but it was difficult to fault this writer. The seminar was to last 2 weeks. Some devotees had taken their entire year's vacation for this. They would drive or walk from their cottages to the bottom of the hill and trudge up the steep, oily dirt road which leads to the cottage porch. Swami Nikhilananda discoursed in the manner of the inspired talks, freely and informally from the Upanishads. He was using his own published translation. Lest anyone suppose that Swami Nikhilananda might be known from his books or even from his lectures in the city of New York, let me hasten to say I saw a different man, just as I had at Douglas College. In the seminar, there was a vitality and an inspiration not seen elsewhere in his life. There was also a feeling of relatedness to the audience which did not come easily in other environments. Explain it as one will, attributing it perhaps to the influence upon him of that special milieu, we were galvanized. There were sharp and penetrating questions he fielded handily. His approach was fresh. In the gathering were physicians, a dentist, an inventor, teachers, clergy, and an editor from one of the prominent publishing companies. One does not pull much wool over the eyes of such a company. It was learned only later that Swami's incarceration had prevented him from sitting for his BA examination, his regret for which can be appreciated when one knows the value placed on degrees and titles by the Indian people. In the afternoon, we would return for singing and meditation. One day only did the strain of the load on Swami's mind become clear to everyone. He absented himself, asking Swami Buddhananda to take over. My notes, such as they are, of the remarks made in these discourses are offered below as unstrung gems. Beethoven said, "I wish I could express 1/1,000,000th of the music I feel inside." One person said, when people were praising a great painting of a sunset, "We are surely seeing only third hand." That is, the original sunset would not be visible to mortal eyes. There is a story of Leopold Stokowski and an Indian veena player. The former was so entranced with the latter's music that he requested him to play for tape recording that Stokowski might take it back with him. The Indian musician declined. "I know," he said. "You will go back to your country and put on my tapes to accompany some cocktail party." We must not vulgarize the sacred. In India, everything that is considered music is regarded as religious. Reincarnation is just in the blood of every Hindu, a according to us, is the necessary corollary of the immortality of the soul. Without the latter, only ethics is left, not religion. Hindus mean by the world, all the worlds, not just this one. Therefore, rebirth is postulated because so many persons die with their desires unsatisfied. Reincarnation gives much consolation for the living of our life, much calmness. People in America are excited now about reincarnation, hoping for further enjoyment, but the Hindus do not want to be reborn. The mango falls, it is ripe, but the mango has a seed for another mango tree. The difference between death and dream is that in the latter, the prana does not leave the body. Where do the materials come from for the new body? We do not deny heredity or environment, but note, we believe the soul chooses just those elements which will help it to manifest the blueprint already given by its past, those which we need to fulfill our unfulfilled desires. We don't pass the buck to our parents or our teachers or to society. The soul has no contact whatever with the body. We lead our daily life by mixing up truth and falsehood. Evolution means that the soul is involved, for some reason or other, in matter, and is struggling to get detached from it. Every soul that comes into this world is provided with a round-trip ticket. A woman brought a month-old baby to see G. Jung and asked for preventive psychoanalysis for it. "I hope it is not too late," she said. "Madam," Jung replied, "you have already wasted 10 months. Two paths are offered to the dying person, the familiar and the unfamiliar, which leads to light. Jung favored the practice of detachment after the midpoint in life, but Plato said we should practice detachment through the whole of our life. Yes, old age is too late. The ethical person's life is based on oughtness. Ethical laws are a sort of device by which we live harmoniously in a discordant world. It is like the band of porcupines arranging themselves in a sunny spot. All reciprocity, however, politely couched, is just that. Ethics can punish, but never redeem, never bring perfection. If you can make a person conscious of his or her own divinity, having seen it yourself, then only can you redeem that person. But a student must follow ethics up to a point. Is the river afraid to flow into the sea? The chrysalis to transform itself into a butterfly? How funny that would be. Even in the waking state, we are in another kind of dream state. Does anyone want to dream all the time, however pleasantly? A study like this helps us to stretch our consciousness. Realization? Well, that comes from God through grace. But we can help you just to get out of this little circle. My family, my business, my center. Teachers can give samadhi and other experiences, but can you stand it? It may be like the janitor winning the sweepstakes. Our body, mind, and senses must be prepared by spiritual disciplines. And will you really enjoy what you have not earned? Since we know realization is really just a matter of waking up, why use the word attainment at all? Only for the sake of the ignorant. It is like purifying water by means of alum. You don't create new water. Remember that the Taj Mahal, St. Peter's Dome, Plato's philosophy, rockets and satellites all have first to be conceived in the mind. Purity, too, is in the mind. Neti neti, this negation process is like a servant entering a strange dark room to find his master where he lies asleep. Light has to light even the sinner for the committing of his crime. Sometime he may discover, I have been going down and down with such speed. If he can just change his direction, he can go up with the same speed. Every object of our perception shows these five characteristics: asti, bhati, priya, nama, rupa, isness, consciousness, dearness, name and form. This list goes from closest to more remote relationship. Form is the furthest from our true being. The self is the cement that holds all these together. A road is full of broken bits of glass. Instead of removing it all before you walk, bit by bit, remove the big chunks and put on a heavy pair of shoes. That's love of God. And then go over. For our lunch and dinner, the elderly Swami Madhavananda and I would journey up the hill to join the main household. Access from the road to the dining room was gained by a long flight of internal stairs. Swami Nikhilananda made the mistake of calling the patient's attention to the railing he had installed from top to bottom. "Please use the railing, Maharaj," he would say. "You will find it much easier, both mounting and descending. We have put the rail there just for you, you know." And so on. Swami Madhavananda would not so much as lay a finger upon it. To relieve this and other frustrations, Swami Nikhilananda resorted to exercise. Thousand Island Park was a walker's paradise, a veritable fairyland of water vistas, gem-like rocky green islands set in crystal currents, shower-borne toadstools springing up as edible umbrellas for the squirrels, brown and black, who ran in complacent abandon everywhere over the rocks and tree roots. Swami knew all the nooks and crannies. He had been so often on the boats which toured the islands that he knew every line and patter of the guides. There was a cove along the river front, reached by one of the lower roads, where he and others so inclined would gather on hot afternoons for a plunge. And he went out walking with one little group after another as the mood struck. Such an hour would be the right one in which to recall for his companions a pair of experiences from his ample store. One concerned a time he had been put up at the home of a husband and wife who were spiritualists, but on whose susceptibility to higher ideals he had endeavored to play. By means of various remarks and suggestions, At the time of his leaving, they wanted to make him some gift. Swami could think of nothing he needed and said so. No, they insisted, he must accept something. They were going out to look for a suitable present. When it was presented, unwrapping it, Swami found it to be a fancy barometer. Oh, he said, as we do under such circumstances. A barometer. I've always wanted a barometer. He already had one. See, exclaimed the wife, didn't I tell you? I told you there in the shop that the spirit was telling me he wants a barometer. The second anecdote is about a couple who used to come to Swami for counseling. In nearly every interview, separately, each would say about the other, Swami, you have no idea how much so-and-so means to me. I just live for him or her. They would make quite a fuss about it. After some years, the husband died. At the widow's next visit with him, Swami inquired kindly how she was getting along now. Swami, she replied, it's the first time since we married that I am able to sleep without a luminol. But Swami also had this to say about marriage. In the Hindu view, marriage is not a confession of weakness, not a concession to sin. It is sacred and mandatory for all but defectives and freaks. It is important to satisfy physiological and psychological cravings. Hindus found this out long before Freud. Weather along the St. Lawrence was perplexing to a Californian. Summer lightning and torrential downpour would be followed in a day or two by lovely hot sunshine, when the steam would rise in clouds. In the last week of our sojourn, I had the privilege of typing for Swami one chapter of the new biography of his guru, Sharada Devi. The book was now nearly ready for the printer. When it appeared in finished form, he sent me an inscribed copy. That week also added substantially to the collection of anecdotes. Swami was once scolded by Swami Turiyananda for 29 consecutive days. It was after the young man had clearly made his choice for the life of the monastery. Now the older began to take just the opposite tack, berating him for his decision to renounce and go off and be with the monks of Mayavati, one of our Himalayan outposts. Such a promising young man, the revered Swami had said. Such a bright future. What a lot of good you could do for India with your gifts of reporting, writing, political analysis, and so on. The two would go out walking, and this harangue would go on and on. It finally wore down the younger man. One day, Swami Turiyananda started out alone. Seeing the new renunciate following him, he called out, What do you want? Well, Maharaj, if you feel so strongly that I have made a mistake and don't want me to... Swami Turiyananda interrupted. Hup! He eyed him sternly, no courage of his convictions. Swami Brahmananda was friendly with the distinguished religious leader Vijay Krishna Goswami, who had been close to Sri Ramakrishna. Once, perhaps, during the Swami's younger days, they were out on pilgrimage together. Vijay had a number of disciples, one of whom was accompanying him in his austerities. Night came and they made camp. Next morning, Vijay greeted Maharaj with a peculiar remark. "Never make a disciple," he said. "Why do you say that?" In the middle of the night, I was rudely awakened by a pounding upon my chest. It was this fellow who had climbed up on me shouting, "Give, give, give." "What do you want from me?" I asked in alarm. "Give me realization. Give it." I doubt whether I have ever so much regretted the close of a summer. The inevitability of farewell and departure, familiar though it is as an aspect of Maya, had a special poignancy here at the park. As Swami Nikilananda had said, "One day you found out that you were born alone and must go out of this world single file." But here one could not simply pack up and exit. The camp had to be broken, the dwellings put to bed for the winter. There was an eerie air about it. Mattresses were hung over chairs, moth flakes sprinkled on floors, lamp cords pulled from their sockets, windows and doors nailed shut, and a brick placed over the chimney. It all looked so final. The shrine room was no exception. Cloths were draped over the statuary. One had somehow to think that the Master and Mother and Swamiji would now go into hibernation, so to speak. To make it all the more ironic, the sun came out in a cool breeze to grace our departure with one of the finest days of the summer.